Station number 15590, Phil Plowright, reel 10.
Mr. Plowright, reel 10. Now, after this short period in the orchard under fire, this was when you were being actually pulled out of the whole area of Monte Cassino, wasn't it? Where did you go next?
We went further south in Italy, towards Naples, I remember, and we didn't really know what was happening. We had the impression that we were going home because of the second European front was imminently about ready for starting, or so we understood from the news that we'd had.
This is February 44.
Yes. And we didn't really know, but we found ourselves on board heading for the Middle East. And the battalion was centred along, not far from Ismailia and Cairo. They were quite near, and we were in tented lines on the edge of the desert. And the object of this, what I found out later, was that the division were being given a complete rest, refit and retraining due to the casualties sustained in the previous actions and the morale and all that sort of thing, which was pretty low. And we spent, I don't know how long, in a month or two in the Middle East anyway.
Do you remember much about your time there?
Yes, I remember going to Cairo. I went to the pyramids and the Sphinx. I remember riding on the tram from Giza, where the Sphinx and pyramids were, back into Cairo. That was on that very fast tram. The humorous part about it there was that we'd gone by taxi and we'd already paid for a return trip, but when we got there, the taxis pulled out and left us there. So we caught this tram back, and we piled on the tram, and the natives were riding on the running boards of the tram, clinging on anywhere. And the tram was going hell for leather back into Cairo, one of the fastest things, tram, certainly the fastest tram in the world, we understood. And the conductor came round for the fare, and we signed him a chit, signed Winston Churchill, to pay for it, which he accepted. But they were a canny lot with the Arabs. They certainly were. They were out to do us at every little hand's turn, and they're always begging and shoe shines and things of that sort. But in Cairo, I saw the King Farouk's procession with sirens and outriders and everything, and the whole city stopped when he passed by. There's some wonderful things to see in Cairo. I didn't get the chance to see everything. I was only there for a week. Each battalion was allowed a week there, I think, throughout the whole div, and brigades changed over so that we weren't all there together. Also in the Middle East, we were in what was then Palestine. I went to Bethlehem. I saw Galilee and Mount Carmel, and we used to take, we were not far away from Netanya, near Haifa. And we were able to use the beach there and swim and relax there.
You were just training in Palestine, were you?
Yes, and then later on we moved a bit further away again. We went up to from Palestine over Mount Hermon into Syria, and I was able to go to Damascus. I saw Damascus.
Now, there was a big exercise, apparently, in Syria. Do you remember much about
yes,
that?
Yes, I do. We were in this barren area about 20 miles from Damascus, and we had exercises, battle exercises, and also the non-commissioned officers and officers went off on another exercise without troops, leaving the troops behind, and we had about a week, I remember, or something like that, away from the battalion with special training for the NCOs and officers.
What sort of thing?
We had map reading, special map reading, and we also took some officers that had come from units that were being disbanded, like the light ACAC, which hadn't been used since the African days, and they were converting officers from there into infantry officers, and I had a squad of officers training them in certainly recognising the German small arms characteristics, their characteristics of the machine gun MG-45 and the MG-38 and the Schmeisser, and recognising mines, telltale signs for looking for mine and the location of them.
What sort of thing?
Well, the Germans did, in fact, they made notices. They had notices showing where their mines were for their own use, and they left this. They always put this notice on. There was a skull and crossbones, and underneath it said "Achtung Minen," which was if you could spot one of those, you knew that. There were mines, going to be mines in the vicinity, and he came across several mines, the teller mines and shoe mines, the wooden ones, and even the ones that they were anti-personnel mines, and they stuffed everything in those, bits of shrapnel and that sort of thing, and they did cause havoc as well.
What were these officers like as compared to your own officers?
Very good. Very good. I, in fact, finished up with an officer from this, a fellow called Greenwood. He was a really gentlemanly sort of chap, and when we went back to Italy, he became my platoon officer, ultimately. There were one or two others. There was a bloke called Jimmy Hoy. He became the commander of the Pioneer Platoon, and on an attack on Monte Vecchio, he was something of a hero in that part of it. He blew up the walls surrounding it. There was one or two others whose names escaped me, but. Anyway, I thought they were a decent lot, and they.
Did you get any NCOs from them?
No, not that I remember. Not that I remember.
And while you were in, pastime, were you aware of the trouble between the Jewish population and the Arab population?
No, not really. It didn't affect us. The when we had exercises using. Things like mortars and anti-tank guns. A lot of the targets, they targeted Arab villages. I must say that the Arabs had been notified, but they used them in that area. They used the arms to line up the sights on the villages, and some of the shells or the mortar bombs dropped quite close to where the Arabs' houses were. The Arab houses, in fact, weren't very substantial. They were only built of mud and wattle and that sort of thing. They were very poor, the Arabs in that area. The other thing I remember about Syria in particular was we crossed over from Palestine into Syria, and it was very hot in Palestine. We'd been near Tel Aviv and Haifa, as I think I told you, and there are a lot of orange groves and what have you around there, and we had tons of oranges. And we were when we moved out into Syria, we were in KD, but we started to climb up Mount Hermon, and the snow appeared, and we were in KD, and we quickly got out overcoats. We were in the back of these six tonners, troop carriers, winding a long, long way, 2 or 3 miles an hour, that's all we were doing. And lining the road were Arabs, and all the time the convoy was proceeding up there, they were holding out their money and bargaining for what they call ganzes, the pullovers. And it became so cold that nobody wanted to part with anything like that. But I had one lad in my thing, in my troop carrier, Gordon Moore, who was a bit of a lad anyway, and he decided he was going to sell, he'd got a spare ganzi. So he held up the ganzi over the tailboard of the truck, and this Arab broke off from the roadside and started to walk at the back of the truck, because, as I said, we weren't moving very fast. And an offer was made, I'll give you 25 piastres, and the usual, oh, get off from you, 30. No, no. And so the bartering went on until the price was decided upon. But no, Gordon Moore didn't want to part with the ganzi, and the Arab didn't want to part with the money. And the convoy started to improve a bit on speed as the incline became gentler. The convoy moved a little bit faster, and the Arab broke into a trot, and they were still, Gordon Moore was still holding out the ganzi, and the Arab was still holding out the money. And in the end, when the convoy moved off a little, even faster still, Gordon Moore snatched the money from the Arab, and without giving him the ganzi, without giving him the pullover. And the Arab started to break into a gallop and kept jumping up onto the backboard of the troop carrier, and Gordon Moore was hammering his fingers to make him leave go. And in the end, we disappeared at a greater speed than the Arab could run, and the Arab was left there without a ganzi and without any money either. And so we proceeded into Syria. We went to a place called El Rama. I remember that. It was nothing. It was just barren hillsides, miles away in the country. And I found out subsequently that the meaning of this was the place of the scorpion. And I can well believe that was true, because there were thousands of scorpions. Turn every stone over and there was a scorpion. And there were millions of these stones littering this barren countryside. And we set up a camp there, and prior to going on these exercises, and as I say, there were scorpions everywhere. We had mosquito nets and had to take precautions about putting your boots under the mosquito net, because scorpions got in the boots, and they were everywhere. Pretty sinister things. There were green ones and yellow ones and black ones. And as I remember, the ones that gave you the biggest bang were the black ones. I never got a scorpion bite, but I do know that men did. actually got bitten and they were very ill with them. Anyway, that's just an aside. We pulled out and we went down to Taranto. That's when we went to Greece. I can't remember where we went to. We embarked again anyway.
This is to come back to Italy.
Mm. And we...
That would be in July.
Yeah, we landed at Taranto. And...
2nd of July, I think.
Yes. And it was very hot, I remember. And we were in this camp. Again, there was a camp not far from Foggia. And we had the news that we had to parade one morning early, about 5 o'clock. Haversack rations were issued. We climbed into trucks and we went a distance of about 20 miles, perhaps. And we lined a road where there were fig trees and olive trees, and the dust on this road was about an inch thick, white dust. And we lined this road, and King George V came to review us. King George VI came. And I remember he was in this jeep, and he had his shorts on, and he had a handkerchief over his knees. I remember that particularly. And before he came, they drove water carts down this road with the taps full open to settle the dust, because the dust, it was just like white flour. It was all over everywhere, and the vehicles were stirring it up. And they drove the water carts down with the taps open, up and down, and we were gagging for a drink. We'd been standing there since sunup, and it was really hot. We saw the king, and after he'd gone, we got back into these 6 tonners again, and we drove back to the area where we were camped.
How did you feel about the king and, you know, things like that when you were thirsty? They were using water to keep dust down.
We didn't feel very good about that, I can tell you.
Was he popular?
I don't think the significance of it hit us. Don't forget that we were now probably hardened men, rather cynical, possibly, in that sort of attitude. There was none of the victory stuff and all the bands playing and that sort of thing that we'd been associated with monarchy. So it was a bit of a letdown in many ways. I didn't feel very elevated to have gone down to meet him, and I must say that I was and still am a good monarchist, if you like. I believed in the king and the royal family, and still do. But I don't think at that time it gave me any sort of uplift, the fact that I was meeting him. However, we moved northwards, and we camped at another place as camps were set up, and that was the area prior to going into what was known, became known as the Gothic Line.
That's on the Adriatic side.
Yes. Yes, it was.
How did you feel about having been sent back to Italy? Did it bother you?
I think it disappointed us, in view of the fact that we'd really got hooked on this going back to England, because we didn't really know where we were going. It wasn't until we got there that we knew where we were. So that people were disappointed, I suppose.
So you were moving up. What are the first operations you remember? There were the operations across the Mataro River. very late August, and then the capture of Monte Fabbri, I can't say these things probably, and then Monte Vecchi. Do you remember anything about that?
Yes, I remember, not the place names, but having been reminded about them, I remember them, yes. The Germans had dug in well. They'd made this Gothic line fortifications. They'd got 88s dug in, and they even got tanks dug in, hull down. They weren't mobile because of the terrain. It was still hilly and rocky and that sort of thing, and some of these places were strong points. Monte Vecchio, in fact, was a strong point. The Germans tended to cut down all trees and things like that that would enable them to enable us to have cover, so that, and enable the Germans to have a good field of fire and a good field of view. And they often became a bit hairy, these frontal attacks, and a lot of them were night attacks or early morning attacks. And
do you remember any of them in particular?
I remember a two platoon attack, and we were attacking a strong point on a hill, a farmhouse, and it was dark when we set off on the attack. And as we approached the farmhouse, it was getting lighter, and there were grapevines surrounding this farm. And as we got nearer to the farm, in fact, we were only several hundred yards away from it, we could discern a Tiger tank parked outside the farmhouse. And there was a sentry on duty there. We saw him strolling about. And we were getting near all the time. We were under cover of these grapevines, getting nearer. There was no artillery barrage or anything like that. It was to be a surprise attack. We getting closer, and the sentry must have heard the noises of the attack, and he gave the alarm, and a chap jumped out of a bedroom window and straight onto this tank and went into the turret, started the engine up, and the gun started to move round towards us.
What were you doing?
We were face down in the vines. We knew we were going to be in for a bit of a hammering then, because the Tiger was pretty. We got the big gun on, the 88 on, and machine guns and what have you. And one lad there called Jones, Scouse Jones, we called him. He broke away and went from the rest of his platoon. He ran on in front, and he bobbed a Bakelite grenade into the top of the tank. And the Bakelite grenade was a phosphorus grenade. And it went off, and the whole tank brewed up with this chap inside. Or one chap, as I know to, certainly. And before... And then an officer jumped out of the same window and went in to try to rescue this fellow that was in there, because the tank was now blazing. And the ammunition was going off inside. You could hear that banging away. And Jones shot this officer as he went into the... tried to get into the tank. And then the turret blew off with the explosions, and the whole thing was one inferno. And there were two or three more Germans in the house. They surrendered. That was a pretty nasty moment.
What sort of a man was Jones? I mean, what had made him do it?
Jones, we never knew. He was not a particularly good soldier.
In what way?
He'd been one of the... what we called the flankers.
Skyvers?
Yes, yes, he was not a reliable sort of bloke, and it's completely out of character, this was. We never knew.
He never said?
No, no. He took it all, he got the decoration for it, and but we were never able to sort of analyse it, because in later months, when a mess was set up, he was given a job as a waiter in the sergeant's mess, and he became insubordinate and finished up with being punished for it. Anyway, I don't even recall how he was punished, but he was certainly punished and kicked out of the mess, in spite of the fact that he'd been decorated. Another episode of bravery was a man called Stevenson, Corporal Stevenson. I remember he came from Eastwood, near Nottingham. And again, we were attacking a German strong point, which was in a house with a very large field of fire. And we were moving, getting towards it, when the Germans opened up on us with small arms, and we had to get to ground. And every time anyone moved, or any sign of any movement at all, the Germans opened up on us. And we lay there on the ground, didn't know really what to do, for the best. We weren't far off this farm thing, and there was no tanks or anything in support, no artillery, and the sun became so hot, and we lay there and really stewing under the sun. It was really hot. And Stevenson, he dashed out, and there were Bren guns giving him fire, covering fire, and he dashed into this old farm building, and we found out that there were German machine guns in the house itself, because the windows had been barricaded. And Stevenson ran up to this farm, firing his Tommy gun as he went. And there was a German bloke, a German soldier, outside the farmhouse itself. And I think there were some huge wine butts. And he jumped in there, the German did, into the wine butts. And Stevenson, Corporal Stevenson, sprayed these wine butts with Tommy gun bullets with the German inside. And eventually he single-handed captured this this position, this German strong point, and there were two or three prisoners, and they found this other fellow in the wine butt with wounds, shotgun, Tommy gun wounds, and they got him out, and they called our MO to him, but they couldn't do anything for him. And Corporal Stevenson was decorated. And not long after this, he was invalided out with TB. That was the awful thing. And we reckoned that he knew that he'd got TB, and TB was a killer in those days. There was no cure for it. And we think, analysing it and talking about it months and months later, that this prompted him to do what he did.
Were you ever tempted to any one of these acts of suicidal bravery?
No. No. I was glad of being a bit cautious in one another occasion. We we were further up the line. There were many of these sort of skirmishes.
You don't know the names. There's no point going through the list of names.
No. I remember the names on them afterwards, but Montevecchio, I remember. In particular, Montevecchio was standing there on one in like a picture postcard village.